Welcome to our fourth episode of Grading Garpax, an exclusive series from the Rebuildable Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Gentile, and so far we've done an overview and graded the earliest portions of the John Paxson and Gar Forman reign. Today, we're going to grade the final portion from the 2014 offseason to the present. But before we get started, let me set the stage on this final period. The last 5 years of Bulls basketball can best be described as a period of transition. The 2014-15 season is often viewed as the last year the franchise was close to contention. After missing out on Carmelo Anthony and Kevin Love in the summer, Garpax responded by signing veteran Paul Gasol and other key role players, including 2011 draft pick Nikola Mirotic. During that summer, there were many questions surrounding the team. Could Derrick Rose regain his form after yet another injury-riddled season? Would the drama between head coach Tom Thibodeau and the front office finally come to a head? How would Jimmy Butler perform under the pressure of turning down a contract extension? Despite the questions, the Bulls still notched 50 wins and earned the third seed in the East. Thibodeau navigated the team during stretches of injuries and self-induced drama. Gasol and Mirotic proved to be key pieces throughout the year. And Butler? Well, his bet on himself paid off. The fourth-year guard increased his scoring average by almost 10 points, earning a trip to the All-Star Game and winning the NBA's Most Improved Player Award. Rose, who missed some time with another meniscus injury, returned to have a solid postseason that year. After eliminating the Bucks in 6 games in Round 1, the Bulls faced off against an undermanned Cleveland Cavaliers team in the semifinals. After Rose hit a walk-off buzzer beater to put the Bulls up 2-1, Game 4 was another close contest. After taking the lead with only seconds left, it looked like the Bulls were poised to take a commanding 3-1 lead on the Cavs. However, LeBron James happened. James hit a buzzer beater of his own to even the series. The Bulls would go on to lose the next 2 games and were eliminated from the postseason. In the weeks following the 2015 season, the transition slowly started. The animosity between Thibodeau and Garpax was beyond repair. Despite winning seasons and countless postseason berths, Thibodeau was fired in May and replaced by Iowa State head coach Fred Hoiberg, who was being lauded around the league for a pace and space offense. In Hoiberg's first season at the helm, the front office decided to keep the same squad as the year before, but this time, the results weren't as bountiful. The team limped to a 42-game finish in 2016, missing the postseason for the first time since 2008. During the 2016 offseason, the team continued to transition. Following an inconsistent and inefficient year, the Bulls traded Derrick Rose to the New York Knicks. They also let veteran role players walk, including All-Star Pau Gasol. GM Gar Forman was quoted as saying that the team was looking to get younger and more athletic. However, the Bulls stunned many analysts and even their own fan base with their moves that summer. The team signed veterans Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade to play alongside Butler. The three alphas would go on to have a shaky season, filled with many moments of drama, tension, and inconsistent play. Still, the team finished with 41 wins, enough to earn the 8th seed in the playoffs. Despite taking a 2-0 lead against the top-seeded Boston Celtics, an injury to Rondo hurt the Bulls' rhythm, and the Celtics charged back to knock off the Bulls in 6 games. After the 2017 season, it was clear that more change was needed. Garpax hit the reset button again by trading Butler to the Minnesota Timberwolves, acquiring young pieces like Zach LaVine, Chris Dunn, and rookie Lauri Markkanen. Since that trade, the Bulls have been working to build a young, sustainable core. While both the 2018 and 19 seasons weren't pretty record-wise, there were some signs of growth. We've seen LaVine come back strong from his ACL injury, showing that he's capable of being an offensive threat from both inside the paint and from deep. After a strong rookie campaign, Markkanen finished his sophomore season, averaging nearly 19 points and 9 rebounds per game, while shooting 36% from three-point range. 2018 draft choice Wendell Carter Jr. only played 44 games due to injury last season, but even in limited action, he showed that he's more than capable of being a game changer on the defensive side of the ball. Combined with 2019 draft pick Kobe White and acquisitions like Otto Porter, Thaddeus Young, and Tomas Satoransky, things seem to be trending up for the Bulls heading into the 2020 season. Still, there have been some question marks throughout this latest rebuilding process. Why did Garpax hand $36 million to Cristiano Felicio? Should the team have tanked more in 2018? Was signing Jabari Parker last summer a big mistake? And was the front office correct to hitch their wagon to Jim Boylan as head coach? For better or worse, Paxson and Forman are in the midst of another rebuild. The first one started 16 years ago, and we've seen many restarts since. Unlike those other rebuilds, can this one finally get the Bulls their seventh championship, or will it just be another failed attempt to turn the team into a title contender? All right, so let's bring in our guests to help us grade this period of the Garpax era. These two are like oil and water, so it should be a lot of fun. Our first guest can be heard on the Locked On Bulls podcast, and he's the host of Bulls Outsiders on NBC Sports Chicago. Matt Peck joins us. Matt, how's it going? Thanks for coming on.
Of course, Matt. As always, a pleasure to join you here on Rebuildable. I'm excited, and I can't wait to be chatting with not only you, but my other co-guest as well. He's one of my favorite people in the world.
Our second guest can be heard regularly on various Bulls podcasts. He's from ChicagoBullseye.com. He's the pride and joy of Bartlett, Illinois. He's C-Red Fred. How you doing, Fred?
Oh, living the dream. Living the dream, man. It's an honor to be on here. Really excited to be on with my co-voice of the fan. I consider it a tie after rewatching the tape. So I have a ton of respect for Matt Peck. And, you know, I know we joke around and act like we're mortal enemies online, sometimes on Twitter. But overall, he's definitely one of the few people that I really respect with a contrarian viewpoint to mine. Yeah, I think a lot of people that disagree with me, I just can't help but not respect them. He's one guy I do respect.
Well, thank you,
that's
Fred.
That's a compliment.
It is, and I will gladly reciprocate that for the most part.
Thanks.
There are some days, like yesterday, when you were talking about the Bulls 9-0 start, where it's hard for me to feel that way. But
deep down, you know it's true. It's going to happen. You can feel it.
Of course it is.
Can we talk about that at all? How exciting is that? Oh, my God. Isn't it great? I mean, look at that schedule. We couldn't ask for a better cupcake schedule to start off the season.
It's good. 5-0, man.
Yeah, 5-0, absolutely.
All right, 4-1.
I just want to let the listeners behind the curtain just a little bit. So my initial goal was really not to capitalize on the Peck C-Red Fred rivalry, but when I was putting this series together, I asked all the contributors to pick which period of the Garpax era they preferred to talk about, and without hesitation or knowing which person picked which podcast, both Fred and Matt chose this one, so it happened organically. I didn't try and cash in on it. Let me actually start with you, Matt, and then we'll go to Fred. Matt, what do you think makes this period from the 2014 offseason to right now intriguing to talk about?
Well, I think it is so interesting, and this was the phase that I wanted to talk about because, I mean, it is so, it's night and day when you talk about the tail end of the Tibbs, you know, D. Rose, Joakim, and then the Jimmy years, and then the transition from Tibbs to Fred, and then the failure of the Jimmy being the key piece, and the failures around trying to build a team around him, to now starting over. It's like, to me, it's the most interesting phase of the Garpax regime because so much has happened. So much crazy shit, pardon my French, has happened in the span of just these last 5 years that for the, you know, overall negativity of the fan base, which I think Fred is right about, a lot of that is in the early part of this 2014 to 2019 period. But personally, I'm very intrigued about what they've done over the last year or even the last 2 years. And I think that there is some optimism there. So that's why I think it's fascinating, is because, like, I think it covers the entire spectrum of, like, a hopeless organization to one that still has a long way to go, but you can actually start to see some signs of positivity.
Yeah, so I chose this period, too. I guess kind of following up what Matt said, I just think it's a fascinating period in that I think most Bulls fans, if you pull them off the side of, you know, the road and ask them, you know, what do you think was our last legitimate chance to win a title? They would say 2012, and that ended with Derek's, you know, ACL tear. And I don't believe that. I do believe that 2014-15 team, if Gasol had remained healthy in the playoffs, I do think they had a legit chance to beat Cleveland and go on to the championship. Now, beating Golden State would have been a very tall order, but the Bulls had a really unique team that year. I kind of felt like they were much better than an actual record. They still won 50 games. Any team that wins 50 plus games is a rock solid team, but they lost a ton of games they should have won that season. Like, the team really should have been more around 55 to 60 wins that year. And they just had some really pathetic, ridiculous losses. Just one comes to mind off the top of my head. They lost a game at home to Dallas with Heinrich with one of the dumbest fouls I've ever seen at the end of the game on a three-pointer. There were so many games like that where the Bulls just handed it away. And I really felt like they had the opportunity there to get to the final. It didn't work out. Gasol got hurt in the second round of playoffs. But I also kind of point to this period. Is this where it really turned? And as far as the fan base negativity, and I had touched on this with Mark Schanowski on an NBC podcast a couple weeks ago, but I actually reached out to a friend of mine who works in the social media space, and they actually track on Twitter. They're able to track negativity of tweets. It's kind of a long, complicated algorithm they utilize. But I had a hunch at the time that the Bulls had the most negative fan base. I think Zach Lowe mentioned that on his podcast. And I asked him if he would do me a favor and run the numbers. And it wasn't the Sacramento Kings. It wasn't the Suns. It wasn't all these teams with, you know, just horrible records over the past decade. It was the Chicago Bulls.
So, if you don't mind me jumping in on that, is that a Russian bot type program that they're running there? Or like... How does that work?
Bulls Blogger is the Russian bot. He's the guy who is meant to sow division among the fan base, just like they did in our elections. So I think that's what the Russian bot is. No, but it's really I hope they're going to have him on my podcast sometime in the next couple months to go over how they track that. But it really seemed to ring true with me. Now, in fairness to the organization, which is called Zoomf, the testing was all done before the draft and all the free agency period. And I think, Matt, you would probably agree with me on this, is that there's definitely been a significant change, I think, towards the positive, at least in the past 30 days or since the draft and free agency. So that's a good sign. I didn't think it could get much worse before that. I do think that things are headed in a positive direction.
So for those of you just tuning into this series, Matt, Fred, and I will grade all of Garpax's moves in this period on a scale of 1 to 5. And those categories we're going to cover are the drafts, free agency signings, trades, and coaching decisions. Our grades will cover the good, the bad, and even some of the missed opportunities. So let's get to the drafts from 2014 to the present. From 2014 to the present, you could call Garpax's draft record solid, with 2014 being the lone exception. During that draft, the Bulls were looking to add shooting depth to their roster. That evening, they traded the rights of number 16 pick Yusuf Nurkic and number 19 pick Gary Harris to the Denver Nuggets for a package featuring the draft rights to number 11 pick Doug McDermott. Despite a decorated college career at Creighton, McDermott's offensive skills never really translated to the NBA. He was a streaky shooter at best and struggled mightily to create his own shot in the paint. Not to mention, his defense was woeful, to say the least. He never really caught his footing with the Bulls. As Nurkic and Harris went on to have solid NBA careers, McDermott was traded during his third season in Chicago. Since then, he's become a spot role player off the bench, playing for four teams in the last three seasons. When you remove the McDermott selection, the other picks are much better for Garpax. They rebounded nicely in 2015 by picking Arkansas big man Bobby Portis 22nd overall. In hindsight, Portis easily could have been a lottery pick in that draft. Despite bizarre episodes that included a burnt foot and punching Nikola Mirotic, Portis went on to have a solid career with the Bulls. After failing to reach a contract extension with the team last offseason, Portis was traded in a package that landed Otto Porter near last year's trade deadline, and he cashed in this summer with a nice $63 million contract with the New York Knicks. In 2016, the Bulls chose Michigan State's Denzel Valentine with the number 14 pick. While Valentine has been oft injured and by no means a game changer, he hasn't been terrible. And seeing as the 2016 draft was weak, picking Valentine wasn't really the biggest sin. Yes, Pascal Siakam, who was selected number 27, has become a stud, but you'd be hard-pressed to find scouts who thought he could be a future All-Star. The last three drafts have been some of Garpax's best during this period, as they've been vital to the direction of their latest rebuild. On draft night 2017, the Bulls traded Jimmy Butler to the Minnesota Timberwolves. The trade netted them young players like Zach LaVine and Chris Dunn, as well as the number 7 pick. With that pick, the Bulls chose Arizona forward Lauri Markkanen. The 7-foot Finnish forward has shown the makings of being a solid stretch 4 in the league, He's averaged just under 17 points and nearly 8 rebounds per game in his first two seasons, shooting about 36% from three-point range. The following year, the Bulls selected Duke center Wendell Carter Jr. 7th overall. Despite missing 18 games due to injury, Carter showed that he has the ability to be a disruptive force on defense, and he has the instincts to morph into a solid offensive player as well. Markkanen and Carter are nowhere close to finished products, but both players have high enough ceilings that could help the Bulls become a perennial playoff contender. This past summer, the Bulls added to their young core, drafting North Carolina point guard Kobe White 7th overall, and using their second-round pick on athletic Arkansas forward Daniel Gafford. Some moves have made it hard to give Garpax an easy A for their drafts in this period. In addition to the McDermott pick, you can point to a couple of things that the Bulls did that were very questionable in the draft. There was an awkward promise to Chandler Hutchison at number 22 in 2018, and the decision to trade their second-round pick in 2017 for cash considerations was puzzling after publicly saying they were trying to get younger. However, it's still fair to say that most of their draft moves, especially in the last 3 years, have helped establish a young core in their latest rebuild. All right, we have to start with the 2014 draft. I feel like the trade for Doug McDermott was a factor in sort of setting back the franchise. Starting with you, Matt, where would the Bulls be right now had they kept both Nurkic and Harris in that draft?
I mean, obviously, it's hard to say because so many other, you know, it's like the butterfly effect. If that changes, then this changes, then that changes, and who knows what the roster would be. In a hypothetical world, if you think about the player that Jimmy Butler was becoming in around that time, 2014, and the pieces that they could have added to build around him being Yusuf Nurkic and Gary Harris, do I think that had they done that instead of trading up to get Doug McDermott, which was a giant flop, a giant bust, could they have been in a more interesting position to build a contender around Jimmy? Yeah, I think that possibility is out there. And I think that, like, that's not necessarily the reason why the front office should get absolutely raked for making that trade. Because it's you know, all of these hypotheticals and hindsight's 2020 and all that kind of stuff. When you look at the player Doug McDermott was and you look at the production that McDermott gave the Bulls while he was here, and you look at the production that Nurkic and Harris have given their teams in the same time span, it's not about, well, what could have been, what might have been with the Bulls. It is player production, and it is clear that they blew that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is, without a doubt, you know, obviously the worst move in retrospect that the Bulls made on draft night, probably, without a doubt to me. I mean, you know, you had an opportunity with two players that are obviously rotation players in the league. You know, I completely understand the thinking. If you go back to that period, everybody in the organization was behind moving up. You needed to get shooting, was sorely lacking for that team. And nobody was a better shooter probably in that draft than Doug McDermott, or very few were. I was ecstatic about it because I thought Doug was going to be a very good NBA player. I mean, I think we kind of rewriting the history on this thing. You know, he's not a good NBA player, but he's still in the league. He's not like a guy who's out of the league. He was just given a, you know, $7 million a year by the Indiana Pacers. He's a lifetime 40% shooter from three in a league that demands good three-point shooting. Was it a good move for the Bulls? No. I would counter, let's just pretend, though, we kept both these players. Like, I think Gary Harris and Nurkic are kind of like, Gary Harris is making $18 to $21 million over the next 3 years per season. His, you know, averaging 12 points a game, two assists, two boards. I think he's like, people talk like he's like an all-star. He's not even remotely an all-star. He's a very good defensive player who's, I think, a 36% career three-point shooter, a little bit undersized. He's 6'4", 205. He's basically the same size with a shorter wingspan than Chris Dunn. He's an undersized shooting guard. He's not like a – you know, I have a few friends in Denver, and it's kind of like the general reaction is, great defender, but is he a real difference maker?
Let me follow up with this real quick, though. So if you go back to 2014, though, you're getting a young Gary Harris as a role player off the bench. He's not necessarily on your roster at 18, 20 million.
Tom Thibodeau, so he wouldn't have played. And Tom, I mean, he wouldn't have had any time. And he was terrible in his rookie year. He shot like 30%. So I don't think he would have made a difference at all in that team. It's the argument of, you know, 3 years later, he had a really nice season. Now, he had a major regression last year. And he's, first of all, one thing about Gary Harris, people, he's always hurt. He's missed at least, I think, 25 games every year of his career. You know, I don't want to act like he's not a good player, but I think it's like the delta between Doug McDermott and these two players isn't as big as we like to make it here in Chicago. Nurkic, oh my gosh, like to me, he's the guy who would have been great in 1989. He's not great in today's NBA. He shoots 66% from the line. I think he's averaged about under 25 minutes per game because you can't play him at the end of games. In a league that's going small, he's kind of like a dinosaur. He's a good rebounder. That's about it. He's a good pick setter, but you know how much did Portland suffer with his injury? They went to the stinking conference finals. It's like they wouldn't have been any better. I don't view him as like, oh my God, did we blow it there? Do you guys feel that way? Do you wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because Nurkic isn't on the Bulls roster?
I mean, I think some of it is recency bias because we just saw Nurkic have a really good season before he went down. I mean, he was averaging 15 and 10 before he got hurt this season. Like that's nothing to sneeze at.
No.
And I also think that you're underselling Gary Harris by overselling the common narrative of what Gary Harris is. People don't talk about Gary Harris like he's an all-star. And to your point, he has had some injury problems, but he played 76 games his second season. He played 67 games 2 seasons ago. So you're never, you know, or like has always missed at least 25. That's not right. Other than his rookie year, he's averaged 12, 14, 17, 13. I mean, you put that production and Yusuf Nurkic's production together, and if they were on the Bulls in their prime as they developed, assuming they had the same player development, then yeah, collectively that's a lot more valuable than Doug McDermott hitting the occasional three-pointer.
Is Nurkic? Would you rather have Nurkic or Wendell Carter Jr.? Let's put it that way.
I mean, the ages they are, Wendell.
No, just like yeah. I mean, like even going forward, like Wendell Carter Jr. is gonna be. I think already he's a better player, defensive player than Nurkic. I think he's going to be a better player next year already. It's not like I wonder where the Bulls would have been if we would have had those guys. Like I think we were headed right exactly where we were with the three alphas. Like we would have been in that same area around 500. Gary Harris, Nurkic, and Butler leading us to first or second round exits. And I even think the team probably would have been. Could have potentially been worse. I don't think like if we would have drafted those guys, it's really almost impossible to say, right? You could because those are assets you could have turned into something else. But I don't like Gary Harris at $18 million a year and making $21 million in 2 years. And most guys in Denver don't either.
But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about 2014 draft night.
Oh, it's a mistake. We all are in agreement there. Okay. They shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying. I think if we would have drafted Gary Harris and Nurkic, I don't think we would have been anywhere near like title hunting.
Oh, I don't either.
I don't think so either. No, like, and I think, yeah, it was more the question of McDermott versus those two. And I think hands down those two over McDermott, and it's not even close. I want to actually have another note from the 2014 draft that I want to get to. John Paxson, when they had acquired Zach LaVine in the Jimmy Butler trade, he had mentioned that LaVine was pretty high on their evaluation pre-draft process. And I'll start with you. I'll start with you, Fred, on this one. Why do you think they did go with McDermott? You hinted to shooting. Do you think that was the biggest reason they went McDermott over a guy like LaVine who ended up going a few picks later?
That's 100% the reason. I mean, they still had Rose under contract. They already had a point guard. LaVine was kind of a point guard coming out of college. Most people felt that's where his position was going to be, is either at the point guard. I mean, also more time probably at the point. I recall that. I was not a LaVine fan out of UCLA. I did not expect him to make this jump. I was not a LaVine fan until 2017 before he tore his ACL. I mean, he clearly made a massive jump there, but I think most Chicagoans weren't really on the LaVine train until this year. And that was pretty clear in reaction to the Bulls matching the Sacramento Kings offer. So, it's a testament to, I think, Pax's ability to judge talent, because I was for Wiggins. I felt the whole time that the Bulls should have demanded Wiggins and you know the Markkanen pick and Dunn over LaVine. And now in retrospect, is there anyone that would rather have Wiggins over LaVine?
That's one of those 7% times when you're wrong, Fred. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That's right. Seven. But I mean, wouldn't you concur there? I mean, I, at the time, I kind of felt like the Bulls should have demanded more. I thought Wiggins was more. And now I think, is there anybody that would prefer Wiggins over LaVine?
Well, and I mean, yeah, obviously now I think most Bulls fans would be happy that we got LaVine instead of Wiggins. But Matt, to your original question of, you know, Paxson and his comments about also really liking LaVine in the draft. And, you know, maybe was it just because that they really liked Dougie as a shooter and they were addressing that need. And, you know, they are in, you know, Fred, you mentioned the Bulls already had their guard at Derrick Rose. So maybe the, you know, college version of LaVine kind of doubled down on that and they didn't see it as a necessity. We can't ignore the one glaring, obvious fact about why they liked Doug McDermott. The Gar Foreman Ames Iowa connection. People can scoff at it. People can laugh at it. But I swear to God, it's like the dude has three names in his Rolodex, and they all live in Ames, Iowa. Dermot and, you know, the Creighton connection, the Ames, Iowa connection. Like, that is at least 50% of the reason they drafted Doug, and
I'm not
kidding.
How do you explain Tibbs liking him? He had no Ames, Iowa connection. Tibbs loved him. He was adamant about drafting him. He thought he'd be a great fit. I kind of felt like that pick was more unfit. Like, the Bulls clearly needed a shooter, and they're like, all right, here's a guy. He's four, you know. Was he a four-year or three-year? I think he was a four-year player, and off the top of my head. And I mean, here's a guy who should be able to come right in.
He was 23 years old his rookie year.
Unbelievable.
His rookie year, he was 23.
Yeah. But, you know, in fairness to McDermott, though, I didn't think Tibbs really utilized him correctly. I mean, just my opinion. I mean, I understand, and this is a bigger issue, is, you know, Tibbs is the coach. There's two types of coaches. There's coaches who make the talent adapt to their system. There's coaches who make their system adapt to the talent. And Tibbs is clearly one of the Bobby Knight ladder types. And there's good coaches in both groups. And Tibbs is one of those guys that, this is my system, this is what we're going to run. And how we're going to play it. I mean, that interview with Chris Dunn that I think both of us were discussing with Matt and I recently in The Athletic, where he's talking about his time here. One of the things that was kind of overshadowed was he was talking about his first year in Minnesota, and he didn't even play point guard. He was talking about how Tibbs was playing him, like just have him go basically play a shooting guard in the corner. Like, Tibbs is a fantastic defensive coach, but he does not, I did not feel at any time. Well, did he adapt his talent to change his system?
And rookie year Doug played 9 minutes a game. But guess what? Even at age 23, rookie year Doug McDermott, still very wet behind the ears, could not play a lick of defense against NBA caliber talent. And Tibbs, as much as he loved to bash him, Fred, the calling card of those Bulls teams, outside of having a young flash-in-the-pan MVP Derrick Rose, their calling card was being an elite defensive team back when that was a way you could still actually win in the NBA. And Doug was not part of that equation.
I think it's best we move on from the 2014 draft. I think we're talking too much about Doug McDermott anyway.
Yeah, we're going to be here like for 8 hours.
Let's do some rapid-fire questions. First, starting with Fred. What do you think Lauri Markkanen's ceiling is, and then his floor?
His ceiling is top 10 player in NBA. Absolutely. To me, it's all dependent on him shooting the three better. That's the one aspect of his game where he came into his league. This is a guy who's an elite shooter. He's been shooting at a 36% rate, which is fantastic for a big man, but it's not elite. I think this guy's got elite ability. If he hits 40% from the three-point line, you're going to see guys just come out on him much harder, forced to guard him out that far and really play him much more aggressively. It's going to open up the aspect of his game I've been pleasantly surprised with, which is his ability to drive. And he's got these nice little moves off the dribble in the lane, which have really impressed me. I think his ceiling is, you know, top 10. So it doesn't get much better than that. I think he's got baby Kirk, baby Dirk ability. He could be that good. It just depends on him hitting that three at a significantly higher rate you know, 40% is significantly higher than 36. So he's got to improve that. But I yeah, that's where I have him. His floor, you know, where he's kind of at now, 36, 18 points per game, 10. You know, it's possible that he could just be a 36% three-point shooter and just 18 and 10. The one little potential negative is I don't sometimes feel like he gets lost, like he's not assertive enough on the offensive end. And all the great players demand the ball and have a little bit of that selfishness you need on that side, for lack of a better word. That's my only potential issue with him. And then also, obviously, you get a little concerned at some of the injuries he's had. So, especially last year.
I pretty much agree with Fred across the board there. I think he does have a ceiling of being an all-NBA caliber player, top 10, 15 player in the league. And the floor, I have a similar concern about sometimes wondering if Lowry is aggressive enough, has a big enough ego. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, it's just like a different thing. You know, Lowry's from Finland. They're all polite, nice people over there. He's not like an American asshole who's like, yo, give me the damn ball. And maybe that's a part of it. Or maybe there is a certain level of timidity to his personality that is hindering him on the court at times. Because, you know, I've said this plenty of times, as much as I love Zach LaVine, what I want to see and what I think has the best ceiling for this Bulls rebuild to work is Markkanen becoming this team's best and most dominant player. So the floor is me worrying about him not asserting himself to develop into that caliber of a player because he is afraid to assert himself. And, you know, there are other elements to his game. Can he actually play the five responsibly, including on the defensive end? We're going to see more of the Bulls trying that this upcoming season. We saw little glimpses of it last season. I do still worry about that a little bit. Is he going to develop a more consistent post game, which we haven't seen much of? I think the three-point percentage is going to come around. I'm not worried about, you know, the highs and lows of his swings of you know, hot streak and then a shooting slump over his first 2 years. I think I attribute some of that to injuries that he's been fighting through. But, yeah, ceiling, all-NBA first team for sure. Floor, a guy who has a lot of potential that he doesn't realize.
All right, second question. Let's go with Matt first. Better draft pick from GarPax, Denzel Valentine or Bobby Portis?
Oh, man. Well, you got to go Bobby, right? Even though he has moved on. Bobby Portis played basketball last season. Denzel did not. I think based on where the Bulls got Bobby at all the way at, pick 22, I want to say, compared to Denzel at 16, I think they got more bang for their buck with Bobby. I do think that the Bulls were just insanely lucky that Bobby turned down the offer they gave him last summer. And then they were able to turn Bobby Portis, along with Jabari, into Otto, which also I will add into my calculation for who was the more valuable draft pick. You turn Bobby Portis, or part of Bobby Portis, you partly use Bobby Portis to get yourself Otto, who I think will, for many reasons, be the most important player on this Bulls roster this upcoming season, especially because of a lack of depth at that wing, which goes to show you that, why am I not high on Denzel? Why do I have no faith in the wings behind Otto on this roster? Because Denzel Valentine is a trillion years old. He can't stay healthy. You know, Fred's going to tell you about his shooting abilities behind the three-point line. Of course, Bobby Portis was a better draft pick than Denzel, who had two broken legs when the Bulls drafted him, and he was a 26-year-old rookie.
Is this like a trick question or something? I mean, how can you possibly – even I, who unabashed Denzel fan, say that, you know, Bobby Portis was clearly the better pick right now, you know, 3 years into this. I mean, if you redraft that pick, I would argue Bobby Portis, he was 22nd. He's clearly probably top 10. He's going to be picked 9, 10, 11 in that draft. If you redo it, Denzel, I thought he had a fantastic second. If he was healthy, I have no doubt he would be a solid rotation player on an NBA team. You can't say that he's been a better draft pick than Bobby Portis with just the fact he's basically missed primarily two seasons. I will say this. If Denzel is healthy, there is nothing on the offensive end of the court that he does poorly. He's an excellent passer. He's an excellent playmaker. He's an excellent shooter. One thing he doesn't do is he doesn't get to the line a lot, but that partly due to the fact he sets up other players so well. He's fantastic on the offensive end. For his position, he's the best rebounder on the team, if we're talking about wings. He's got great length. Now, defensively, yes, he's got issues there, but that length covers up a lot. The seven foot wingspan covers up a lot of problems. He's going to be a major contributor to this team if he's healthy this season.
That's a big if. Next, who do you think will have a greater impact on the franchise? And let's start with Fred on this one. Kobe White or Wendell Carter Jr.?
Oh, Wendell Carter Jr., without a doubt. I think people are expecting a little bit too much of Kobe White. I first of all, I think he's several years away from being a solid rotation player. He's just 19 years old. That position's a lot more is much more difficult to learn, the point guard position. He's kind of a combo guard. I was not blown away with the tape I watched on him in college. I think he does a lot of things very well. Tremendous athlete. I love the speed he plays the game. He had far too many turnovers in the games I watched. That's not going to get better at the pro level. It's a very difficult position to learn. So I think Wendell Carter Jr. has also elite potential. I think he's a first-team All-NBA defensive player with an opportunity to become defensive player of the year in 3 or 4 years. I think he can be that good on that end. And I also feel he's going to develop into a very good shooter. He, you know, shot at a 40% rate, albeit with not a ton of attempts in college. He's got a great passing ability. Every player on that Duke team talked about how underrated he was in that aspect of the game. Wendell Carter Jr. to me is an all-star caliber player. I'm not ready to say that about Kobe White. I think he'll be a very solid starter in the NBA, but I don't see him being an all-star yet. Wow, I haven't seen it.
There's that classic Fred flip-flopping there, Matt. I mean, leading up to the draft, it was all DeAndre Hunter this, DeAndre Hunter that. Kobe White sucks. Kobe White can't play. He shouldn't be starting at UNC. And then when we draft Kobe White, Fred is the biggest Kobe White fan in the world. Oh, my God, I love this kid. He's such a difference maker. He's going to be getting buckets all season long. He's so great. And here we are late summer, late off season. And here he is saying, I'm not really that high on Kobe White. I agree with his answer that Wendell Carter is going to be a bigger difference maker for this team positively than Kobe White. I think those Bulls fans who have been starved for a point guard and were happy to see the Bulls take White, even though he was kind of the consolation prize behind Ja Morant and Darius Garland, I think they're expecting too much from him. I see Bulls fans on Twitter who are like, he should start, or even if not start, he should be playing 25, 30 minutes a game. And I'm sitting here saying, ain't no way that's going to happen. Wendell Carter is going to be a better, more of a difference maker player this upcoming season. And Wendell Carter Jr., assuming he and Kobe White both stick around on this Bulls rebuild for a while, will have the bigger impact. And as Fred said, a lot of that has to do with what we saw from him on the defensive end his rookie year. But I will give a quick shout out to Cole Zwicker, who just recently did an amazing long form piece on Wendell and all the ways that the Bulls should try to highlight his strengths this upcoming season compared to what they didn't do last season. You can see his offensive game really flourish if he's given an opportunity.
Last one I want to throw out here, or who could have more upside, Daniel Gafford or Chandler Hutchison? I'll start with you, Matt.
I'm going to say Gafford. And maybe, again, that could be a little bit of recency bias based on what I saw from him in summer league, but I really love what I saw from him in summer league. He's got that high motor trait that this Bulls front office just has always loved and they've always drafted. Chandler Hutchison, when they made that pick, I was underwhelmed, partly because of like the whole draft promise rumor thing and the fact that he just kind of seemed underwhelming his rookie year. He does everything okay. He's not great at anything. You know, he's a strong rebounder for a guy his size and playing his position. We saw him, you know, do a decent job of grabbing the boards and then pushing the pace in transition a few times this season. But his shot is still just such an unreliable mess to me. And at that position in this league, if you can't knock down the open shot when it comes to you, you're not of much use. Gafford is very much an old school traditional big man who's not going to be learning how to shoot that outside shot anytime soon. But what he does offer as a guy who can run the floor as a big, roll to the rim, grab boards, block shots, his block percentage is just through the roof. And, I mean, he is that, like, high-octane kind of player. I think if you're talking upside, I'm going to give the edge to Gafford.
Well, I disagree 100%. I think Gafford's already at probably near his upside. He's going to be a fantastic defensive big who can test shots, protects the rim, block shots, and he's going to be like a Noah type. He's obviously he doesn't have a great outside jumper. I'm a huge fan of him, but I don't feel like what you see is what you get. And in this league, that kind of player is never going to make a ton of money. He's probably not going to be an all-star, but he's going to be a valuable player that the city's going to love. Hutch, I feel, has a massive upside. And he has all the qualities of an elite three as far as physical qualities that you need to be an elite three, a three and D guy. He doesn't shoot the ball well. Yes, that's right. Not now. But that's something that it surprised me how some players have progressed with that and other players have, kind of fallen off. Obviously, Kawhi was a terrible shooter and he redid his shot. Now, I'm not comparing him to, if he's going to achieve that kind of improvement on his three-point shot. But if he can get around 37 or 38%, Hutch, I thought, was absolutely fantastic right before he left the season. And probably those last five games on defensive end. I was at the Indiana game at home, that great double overtime game. His defense was phenomenal in that game, and I was really kind of focusing in on him. And there's been times, several games I went to last year, there were just moments where I remember one against Denver in the preseason, he had a dunk, and just the whole place was like, we couldn't believe it. I mean, the guy's got physical gifts that are really, I think, quite rare in the league. And to me, the biggest issue with him is his confidence. I don't think he has a massive belief in yourself. You really need that to kind of take it to the next level, and his shooting ability. And I think, his upside, he's got a lot of the physical traits that you need in that position.
So just to recap, Fred thinks that Daniel Gafford's going to be Joakim Noah, and Chandler Hutchison's going to be Kawhi Leonard. That's what I gathered. No.
Is that what you got from that?
At least his optimism on Hutch is nice and high, because we know we're not getting anything from Denzel coming off the bench at that spot.
Oh.
All right, so taking everything into account, Fred, we'll start with you. On a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate Garpax's draft record during this period?
Are you counting the last 2 years?
Yeah, we're from 2014 to the present, so yes.
For the whole period, 3.8.
3.8. Okay. Matt, how about you?
I'm sorry, I can't be that generous. And we do know that drafting is the one thing that those who are defending this front office say that they do well. And I would generally agree with that. But to me, the reason I'm going to go with a 1.5 is that I can't give them a whole lot of credit for the things recently that they've hit on. So 2014 isn't a 1, it's a 0. 2015 and 2016, Bobby Portis and Denzel Valentine and Paul Zipser, let's not forget him, averages out to about
a second rounder.
Okay, whatever.
Hold on a second.
You had your chance to talk.
In
2017, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're going to get to trades later on. Mm-hmm. So the Jimmy Butler draft night trade we can talk about is a different thing, and we can grade. But draft pick, how am I supposed to give them a lot of credit for drafting Lowry when they were originally planning on drafting 16th that night and barely scouted Lowry at all? They didn't talk to Lowry. Lowry said the Bulls never talked to him. They didn't talk to him at the combine. It wasn't like they did a great job picking Markkanen. It was like, oh, well, what do the consensus draft boards say when we are suddenly here at 7 on the clock? Oh, this kid from Arizona who looks like he's a 7-foot shooter? Yeah, let's pick that guy. I'm not giving them a lot of credit for taking Lowry when they got that 7th pick on draft night. 2018, I can make a similar case for not giving them a whole lot of credit. I think most Bulls fans would say pretty happy with Wendell Carter instead of Mo Bamba. Fred, I know you are so anti-Mo Bamba and are counting your lucky stars that we got Wendell instead. But we do generally know consensus about how the Bulls felt that had it gone the other way and they had their choice between the two, they would have taken Mo Bamba. So what, are you going to give them credit for Wendell falling into their laps? No, I'm sorry. And then when it comes to 2019, all right, Kobe White, I guess, you feel the need. You got a young, exciting, score-first kind of guard to add to your young core. We'll see what happens there. Personally, I think that's like an incomplete as far as the grade contribution right now. So collectively, when you think about the misses before the Jimmy trade and the fact that it's hard to give them credit for the draft picks since the Jimmy trade, when you think about the context, I'm giving him a 1.5.
All right, can I jump in here?
Real quick.
I have to address this 2017 myth, which is beyond irritating to me. The Bulls scouted Lauri Markkanen. They scouted him many, many times. There's a massive difference between bring him in your – they didn't expect – or let's not put it this way. They could not telegraph to the rest of the league, or they couldn't even get Mark and his agent to agree to come in for a personal workout because they were picking 16th. So, yes, there's a massive difference between bringing him in and working him out and scouting him. The Bulls scouted Lauri Markkanen without a doubt. They deserve 100% of the credit. There were idiot after idiot complaining about Dennis Smith Jr.
Is that what is that what they told you when they invited you in and gave you a nice tour of the
facilities? That's what I know. That's what I know. I did have conversations, and I do know when they drafted him that I was not happy about that pick. I wanted Malik Monk. Malik Monk was a player I wanted. They took Lauri Markkanen, and I'm like, what the? Most people at the draft party I was at were upset with that pick. They deserve 100% of that of the credit for that, especially when you consider that Josh Jackson was picked ahead of him. Jonathan Isaac was picked ahead of him. Frank, you could go up and down the list in that draft.
Other teams missing ahead of the Bulls makes the Bulls get more credit for making their selection when they did?
Teams missed ahead and behind them. They deserve credit for picking Lauri Markkanen. He's a top five player in that draft.
I'm gonna chime in here. I'm gonna rate this a 3.5 out of 5 for the whole period. I do give them credit because I used this comparison in the last episode. When the Bulls picked Derrick Rose number one, I'm not giving them a ton of credit for that. I'm giving them a little credit though for not buying into the hype of Michael Beasley. And I know that sounds crazy, but at that time there was hype.
Derrick Rose's teammate, Michael Beasley.
Well, and that's true. And I just look at this as, you know what? They didn't make that mistake of not picking the right player at that spot. So I'm going to give him some credit for that.
How low we've set the bar.
I think you can look at both in two different lenses, though. Like, am I going to give him a ton of credit? No. But I'm going to give him credit for picking a player that we just said has a pretty high ceiling. I'm not going to scoff at that at all. They could have bought into a bunch of different players that didn't turn out as good as Lauri Markkanen.
This Bulls blogger Russian bot idea the Bulls don't deserve credit for Lauri Markkanen is insane. It's absolutely insane. He was not the unequivocal unmitigated pick at 7. That's not true. Most people didn't say, "Oh, he's without a doubt the 7th overall pick." That's not a factual statement. Dennis Smith Jr., Malik Monk, all those guys were right up there, I think, ahead of Lauri Markkanen. And for the Bulls to pick him and have him work out like it did, you have to give them credit for it. They did scout him. It just drives me nuts, this argument. Now, your other one about Wendell Carter Jr., I don't know what you're trying to say. Mo Bamba, people wanted to move up to draft Mo Bamba. I knew Mo Bamba was a bum. I know you don't judge people based on their efforts in an empty gym. You judge them based on their game tape. I watched 20 games of Mo Bamba. I was appalled with what I saw. He was manhandled by West Virginia.
Right.
He wasn't good in college.
You're making my argument for me, Fred. We know that the Bulls would have taken Bamba over Wendell if both
were
available.
How do we know that? Who said that? Where are you hearing that?
My sources, reliable.
Who are they?
Reliable sources that I will not name on this podcast. No offense to you, no offense to Matt. I have reliable sources that the Bulls were taking Bamba if he and Wendell were both available. So you're going to give him credit for taking Wendell because he was the second one left. No, thank you.
All right, we're gonna recap real quick and move on. Fred, 3.8 out of 5. Matt Peck, 1.5 out of 5, and I went with a 3.5 out of 5. All right, let's get to the free agency moves from this period. In free agency 2014, the Bulls set their sights on all-star Carmelo Anthony. Anthony, who was still in the prime of his career, was viewed as the final piece to the team's puzzle. Joakim Noah was coming off a milestone season, and Derrick Rose was due back from a meniscus injury. However, Anthony ultimately opted to stay with the New York Knicks. Garpax quickly changed course, signing Pau Gasol, who was 34 at the time. Gasol enjoyed 2 highly productive years with the Bulls, averaging just under 18 points and 9 rebounds per game, and earning all NBA second team honors in 2015. In addition to Gasol, the front office also signed role players like Aaron Brooks and Etuan Moore and brought over 2011 draft choice Nikola Mirotic on a lucrative deal. But it wasn't enough. Combined with more injuries to Rose and drama between head coach Tom Thibodeau, the Bulls' last-ditch effort to contend for a title failed. After extending Jimmy Butler and bringing back virtually the same roster under new head coach Fred Hoiberg, the team regressed to 42-40, missing the postseason in 2016. After trading Rose that offseason, GM Gar Forman told the media that the team was looking to get younger and more athletic. However, they shockingly signed Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade that summer. Both were inconsistent at best, and the Bulls only eked out 41 wins that year. Still, it was good enough to make the postseason. After taking a 2-0 lead on the first-seeded Boston Celtics, the team sputtered in the final 4 games and lost the series in 6. It was after that year that Garpax finally committed to a full rebuild. After trading Butler on draft night 2017, the Bulls signed Justin Holliday and David Nwaba to short-term deals and shockingly re-signed Cristiano Felicio for $36 million. In 2018, Garpax again chose to sit out on the big-name free agents. Instead, they matched a 4-year, $78 million offer sheet from the Sacramento Kings to retain Zach LaVine. They also signed Jabari Parker to a 2-year, $40 million deal that included a team option after the first season. While LaVine showed significant growth in year one of his new deal, Parker was a square peg in a round hole. Garpax claimed he would be a perfect fit at the small forward alongside Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter in the front court, but he rarely played at that position in the regular season. His offense was better suited at the four, and his defense was terrible against any and all positions. Fortunately, the front office was able to flip Parker and Bobby Portis near the deadline to the Washington Wizards for Otto Porter. This past offseason, Garpax added some veteran pieces to complement the young core, signing forward Thaddeus Young and point guard Tomas Satoransky. Both players are expected to get plenty of minutes in 2020. They also filled out the second unit with useful role players, signing center Luke Kornet and re-signing guards Ryan Arcidiacono and Shaq Harrison. Yes, there have been some questionable signings in the last 5 years, especially for a team promising to get younger. While not spectacular, Garpax historically have done a solid job filling out their rosters through free agency over the last 16 years, and this past offseason certainly was a reminder of that. I actually want to start by talking about the pursuit of Carmelo Anthony. Of course, we have the benefit of hindsight here, but I'm actually curious. And let's start with you, Matt. Had the Bulls signed Anthony, what would the short-term impact have been? And that's mainly on the 2015-2016 seasons. And then on the flip side, what would the long-term impact have been from that sign?
Well, obviously, long-term impact, you know, is the easy answer, which is you get a declining, aging Melo who still owed a boatload of money on the back end of that contract. Immediate impact, you could make the argument that if the Bulls had landed Melo, who at that time in 2014 still had a couple of good years left in him, instead of the consolation prize of Pau Gasol, he may have been a better fit with the current core that they had, with a kind of healthy Derrick Rose and a rising star in Jimmy Butler, which was that team in the 2015 playoffs that fell short in the second round against LeBron his first season back in Cleveland. You know, Derrick Rose buzzer beater to win game 3 and then LeBron buzzer beater to win game 4. If you swap out Pau and swap in Melo, and I believe Fred mentioned this somewhere at the beginning of this show, you could make the argument that the Bulls have a better shot at dethroning LeBron's Cavs in that series. I am not convinced that even if they are able to do, I'm not convinced that they could do that with Melo instead of Pau. It's still LeBron. LeBron went to the finals for like 8 freaking straight years in the East for a reason. The Bulls aren't winning a title if they get Melo. To me, that does not change. And guess what? Pau, in his own right, was a 2-time All-Star when he came here because we missed on Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I can't see how anyone could argue that signing Melo would have been a better move than signing Gasol. First of all, Melo in the 2014-15 season only played 40 games. So he spent most of the year hurt, and he would have been hurt for the playoffs, you know, assuming that he would have played out as such. He was never even remotely the same player that he was in 2013-14 season when he was averaging 27 points. After that, he never came close to that. I think he averaged 24 the following year. But after that, he never approached 27 points. Paul Gasol signing is the most overlooked signing in the history of this organization. He was in huge demand from three really good teams. Oklahoma City, there's a Kevin Durant. There's a Kevin Durant film, kind of like an autobiography where he's walking around with cameras, and he was devastated when he actively tried to recruit Gasol. In retrospect, Paul would have probably been better off going with Oklahoma City, but he chose the Bulls to take less money, to sign here for 2 years. Also, the other team, San Antonio, wanted him. The Knicks wanted him. Obviously, not a great team there. But there were several really good teams that wanted Gasol. We got him. He was an All-NBA player. So not all-star, All-NBA, second team that season. He was fantastic in his first year. His second year, there was a significant amount of drop-off. But big picture, Paul Gasol was a home run for that team. If Noah did not decline as badly as he did in that season, the Bulls would have likely been in the finals. And I will stand by that. And obviously, Gasol got hurt in the Cleveland series. But I mean, the rewriting a history about what happened is just amazing to me. It's like the Bulls were up 2-1. Rose hits the shot against Cleveland. They are about to go up 3-1 when the Cleveland idiot coach calls a timeout with none left and the refs ignore it. And it was admitted to. It's like that technical would have given the Bulls the ball and a free throw. The Bulls would have won that game, gone up 3-1. Instead, we all know what happens. You know, James hits the miracle three, wins the game on Mother's Day. It's 2-2. Gasol's already out. So I'm not saying they could have definitely won the series because he was hurt. But I think it's a vastly different situation if they go up 3-1 in that situation. The Bulls were very close that year to getting out of the East.
Fred, since you already touched on Paul Gasol, I'm going to follow up with Matt on this one. How would you describe Paul Gasol's short tenure with the Bulls?
He was a nice consolation prize to what they ultimately failed to do, which was get Carmelo Anthony. I think most Bulls fans agree, hindsight, that we are glad that we didn't have an aging, decrepit Melo on a giant contract had he decided to come here. But, you know, Pau Gasol was a consolation prize. I think for what he provided in the span that he provided, he was a better, more, you know, cost-effective consolation prize than Carlos Boozer in 2010. You know, who they amnestied the same summer before signing Powell. But that's all he was. He was a good consolation prize veteran addition to a middling team who did not make any, you know, grandiose difference, in my opinion. Like, Pau Gasol was not the difference maker the Bulls needed to get to a title. I do not agree with Fred that if Joakim stays healthy, the Bulls with Derek and Jimmy and Joakim and Pau are going to the finals necessarily in 2015. I think it's optimistic, naturally, to believe that. He was a good consolation prize, nothing more, nothing less. And honestly, to me, I think maybe the reason that some people have this, you know, negative feeling about Pau, as Fred was alluding to, is the fact that the way it ended, right? Like, the Bulls in Pau's second season fell apart and failed to make the playoffs in 15-16. And leading up to the deadline, when the Bulls were showing signs of being a middling team, maybe an 8-seed team, there was so much talk around the league about are the Bulls going to look to trade Pau Gasol, get something for him before he walks in free agency for nothing. And Gar goes out there and says, oh, we value Pau. He's a part of our core, blah, 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 blah. They keep Pau for no reason, end up not making the playoffs, and then get nothing for Pau, who was a highly respected, as Fred said, highly sought after veteran player at the time who could provide depth to a lot of playoff-bound teams' front courts. And the Bulls sat on Pau and did nothing with the end of his tenure, instead of trading him when they 100% should have, when they should have faced reality that they weren't doing jack squat that season. I think that's why a lot of people have a negative lasting memory of Pau's impact on this team.
So actually, I want to get into some rapid fire questions again. So starting with you, Matt, what do you think the best signing was during this period?
My joke answer is just bringing Archie Diacono back for a 3-year, $9 million deal. Best signing in the 14 to 19 period, just to get a rise out of Freddie there. Honestly, if you're talking about including matching other offers and signings that are technically free agents, I got to say matching the LaVine, the offer from the Kings for LaVine last year. To me, that is about as good of a free agent signing as the Bulls have made. I know it doesn't, like, you know, technically fit, as because it doesn't count as like going out and landing a big free agent who had played the previous season elsewhere. But if you're talking about impact of this team and trying to think positively about when they've made the right decision when it comes to free agency, yeah, Powell was a nice consolation prize, but that's all he was. We're trying to build something new right now. And for all of the ridiculous LaVine slander that exists on NBA Twitter, I think that for the next couple of years, Zach LaVine is going to be on one of the most valuable team-friendly contracts in the NBA, matching that Kings offer. To some was a no-brainer. To some, it was a difficult choice. The Bulls made the right choice by keeping Zach LaVine.
Before I answer the question, I got to go back to what Matt said about the 2015 trade to Gasol, because this is often brought up as, you know, Bulls failure. What happened in that, right before that trade deadline, this was confirmed by beat writers I talked to, was they had a deal put in place to send Pau Gasol to Sacramento Kings. Part of that deal was that all the restrictions on the dang trade would be removed. And at the last minute, the Kings refused to do that. When they refused to remove those restrictions, that trade became an albatross trade, because the Kings were insisting that the Bulls take on Costa Koufos, who was a doofus and a bum. And he was signed for 4 years at $10 million plus. His contract would have gone off our books, I think, this past season. That's how bad that deal was. And the other guy was Ben McLemore, who was obviously a bust. There was no market for a 35-year-old Pau Gasol, an expiring contract of $7 million, or he was making like $7 or $8 million. There wasn't a market. There were teams that actually, I think, possibly felt the Bulls would just, after the trade deadline, release him to give him a shot to go on with another team, when in reality, the Bulls were very much in the playoff race at that point. The Bulls were hit with more injuries in that 2015 second half of the season. They were 21-12 in January when Noah went out. And then from that point forward, they lost every starter on that roster for the remainder of the season. It was the most underspoken about season as far in terms of injuries, and we've had a lot of them over the last decade.
So is Paul the best signing from that period then because of that?
He made an All-NBA team. Without a doubt, it was a two-year deal. He took less to come here, and to call him a consolation prize is ridiculous. He was the second most desired free agent in that draft class, behind Carmelo Anthony, but behind Anthony, who went just back to his, who just chose more money. The Bulls couldn't pay him more than the Knicks. He said, you know what? I'm going to go back to the Knicks and make more money.
I'm sorry, Fred, but a consolation prize is a consolation prize. Look up the definition. The Bulls first and foremost sought Carmelo Anthony and failed and settled for Pau Gasol. That is a consolation prize.
A consolation prize implies something far worse than the actual prize, when in reality, that's not what Pau Gasol was. In reality, Pau Gasol was a much better option for the Bulls than Carmelo Anthony. That was proven out. He was a short-term deal, a two-year deal. He took less money to come here, which allowed the Bulls to add more players around that team. They were a better team with Gasol than they would have been with Anthony making $30 million a year. They were able to add players because of the fact that Gasol took less money.
Speaking of adding other talent after not paying the entire bank to Anthony, an underrated signing, and then a lot of people got really upset when they let him go, but he earned a payday. Etuan Moore also came to town in the summer of 2014.
Yes. Who would not have been on the roster if Anthony was playing. They wouldn't have had the room to sign, and they had to go with a minimum guy.
Again, for you listeners, this is the rapid fire segment where we try to keep the answer short. That's why I brought you guys on. It's all good. Second question, we'll start with Fred here. Which was worse, signing Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade, or signing Jabari Parker?
Oh God! Well, both of those were positive to me. The Jabari Parker signing, year two of a rebuild. Your goal is to add talent. If you can add a 23-year-old player who averaged 20 points per game in a previous season and take a flyer on that on a one-year deal, you do that all day. 2016-17 was a very interesting season. In 2016, you had almost every team with massive amounts of cap space and a bunch of unrestricted free agents who didn't deserve the money who got them. In prep for this, I went back and I looked at emails from the listeners of the Chicago Bullseye. And here are the names that they brought up that we should sign multiple times, not once. There were some players that were only brought up once. Maurice Harkless, Bismack Biyombo, Chandler Parsons was brought up about 10 emails, and Ian Mahimi. If you look at those four-year deals, Tyler Johnson, John Lauer, Miles Plumlee, Luol Deng, Noah, Evan Turner, Mozgov, Alan Crabb, I could go up and down. There were 30-plus. Ryan Anderson, there were just horrific deal after horrific deal. The Rondo was a no-brainer because it was basically a one-year deal. He just led the league in assists. I thought it was a brilliant signing, and most of the beat writers agreed with it. The controversial one was Wade, and I know Matt has a little bit of a dislike for Wade. I think borders on it's insanity because he's number one legend. He's a legend. He played very well for the Bulls.
He did
averaging 18 points in 29 minutes over 60 games. And he was desired by Jimmy Butler. So the Bulls had three choices. Sign one of the bums I mentioned before to a four-year deal. Option two was do nothing. Or option three was to sign a player like Wade or Rondo. Or
answer the question, Fred. We've all heard the spiel from you before. Answer the question. Which terrible signing was the worst one?
I would say the worst move was probably signing Parker then. If I had to say which ones were worse. That one was worse.
God, I love you, Fred. Look,
I love you too.
To me, the answer to this question depends on whether or not you believed in building around Jimmy. Because if you believed as a Bulls fan in building around Jimmy, then the answer is Rondo and Wade, because those made no sense. Because you added two ball dominant guards who can't shoot to build around Jimmy, a ball dominant guard who at that time was still not very reliable shooting the ball behind the 3-point line. That you know, it was cruel to make those signings and do that to Fred Hoiberg, who did not at all get the pieces that they promised him. If you didn't believe in building around Jimmy and were for the rebuild and starting over, then in that case you might say, well, yeah, they were awful deals, but they were short term. What they really did was shoot themselves in the foot in year two of the rebuild by trying to, you know, pigeonhole Jabari Parker into a position that everyone knew, including Fred Hoiberg, day one of practice, could not play the position they signed him to play. So the answer to the question, which was worse, they were both terrible. They were both terrible.
But you got to pick one.
Wade.
There we go.
I'm just curious. I want to get your opinion. Let's pretend the Bulls had an opportunity. So Denver just had a Denver expert on our show. He confirmed that Denver really wanted Wade. They made a significant offer for him. In their case, it was more for tickets. But they really wanted to get Dwayne Wade that year. Mm. Do you feel if Jimmy Butler would have known that the Bulls had an opportunity to get Wade passed on that, how do you think his reaction would have been?
Meh.
Meh.
Yeah, I don't think it would have affected that much.
Just shocked you don't feel that he would have been outraged.
Yeah, but Fred, if Jimmy thought that the best thing for him and that team was adding an aging Wade to play alongside him, then Jimmy didn't know what was best for him. So who cares if Jimmy was mad about it? Like,
You can't say that adding Wade did not make the team better than adding no one. You don't believe that, do you? Please. You don't really believe that. Adding a guy who averaged 18.3 points in 29 minutes made the team better.
Hollow points from a guy that tore the team apart. Yeah, I do believe that.
Before we grade the entire period, I want to ask about this past offseason. And I'll start with you, Matt. How did you like the signings over the summer, mainly with Thaddeus Young and Tomas Satoransky?
I liked them. I liked them because, as opposed to in years past, recent years past, as we've just been talking about Rondo, Wade, and Jabari, these to me were signings that were actually about making the basketball team better, addressing positions of need, and signing guys who can add to the overall talent and caliber of the team without taking away from and, in fact, enhancing the strengths of the young guys that they are trying to build around. Satoransky and Thad Young are both going to be high efficiency, low usage players whose primary jobs are making the other young guys look good and building them into the stars that they are meant to be, that they can be, while still providing the things that veterans are relied upon to provide. And with Thad Young, it's, you know, two-way play. It's, you know, being a strong body on the defensive end down low. He can score from the post. He's a smart player. He sets strong screens. He does all the little things. And in similar ways, you're adding Satoransky as your starting point guard to play off the ball. Let Zach LaVine be the ball-dominant player. Let Markkanen be the ball-dominant player while also being able to knock down shots playing off the ball and be a solid distributor, one of the best assist-to-turnover ratios among starting point guards with at least 50 starts last season. They are smart moves. They are underwhelming moves from the uneducated fans who thought we were going to go after Kawhi and Kemba and Brogdon and all those players. And they actually look like a front office who knows what they're doing for a change.
Well, the Thad Young move was just an absolute home run. It's shocking that to me that they were able to get him for the money they did. I know for certain my friends who work for the Pacers were, you know, very disappointed that he's out. He is beloved by every member of that organization, by every player who played for that team. The guy is just a complete class act who it's not talked about, but that kind of stuff is very important in building team chemistry and kind of getting around issues that happen in a locker room. And Thad Young is going to be a mass. Well, his improvement won't be just with him. It will be improving the relationships among the team. And I think it's also going to help improve the Bulls, how other players view the Bulls as a potential destination. Like, just look at a guy like Paul George. Paul George loves Thad Young. They're extremely close. And if things don't go well, I mean, I'm sure they will for the Clippers, but any player in the future who's talks to his agent and says, hey, the Bulls are trying to trade for you. Would you want to go play in Chicago? And Thad Young's in the locker room. That's a plus for the Chicago Bulls. That makes it more likely they're going to get a good player. Satoransky, he's an excellent offensive player. I still kind of come back to when the Bulls, there's a lot of good ones in the East, right? You know, you got Trae Young, you got Irving, you've got Kemba Walker. There's a lot of tough players. What do you feel is the best player on the roster today to guard those guys? If you had to say, God, we got to stop this guy. He's going off. Who do you like? Satoransky?
No, I don't. You want us to say Chris Dunn.
Well, I'm just asking. Isn't that the answer? I still believe in Chris Dunn. I like Chris Dunn. He's been buried and put away from the vast majority of the fan base. There's like four or five guys on Chris Dunn Island. I think it's possible Chris Dunn's best basketball days are still ahead of him. I don't think he's I do like Satoransky, but I'm not willing to say right here. I feel strongly about this. I don't think White should be starting. I agree 100%. In fact, I think he should even be out of the rotation at least for the beginning of the season if you want to put him in the best position to succeed. I think that absolutely we should look at Chris Dunn as a potential starter, pushing Satoransky. And for the first time, maybe this will bring out the best in
him. Just so we can remind ourselves once again that Dunn and LaVine have precisely zero chemistry on the court, Fred, is that what you want?
They showed some point. I was at a game against Indiana where he had 17 assists. He had chemistry at times. I agree.
Was that one of those games where LaVine
together.
Wasn't playing?
No, LaVine was in that game. He started that game. Okay. But LaVine, I agree. It's clear that they're not great together, but you can stagger those minutes. You can still start them together and then have LaVine come off and Satoransky. If he earns the position in training camp, you give it to Chris Dunn. If he outplays Satoransky, you put him out on the court and you stagger their minutes as best as you can. It's not always who starts the game, it's who finishes it. I think it's a little bit overrated about that. Like, I don't think the Bulls are going to be awful if Chris Dunn wins the point guard position and the game starts out where Chris Dunn is paired with is Zach LaVine. I don't think we should all just, call it a season.
It goes back to your comments earlier, Fred, about John Paxson and sometimes being like, too honest and not really thinking about what he's saying, because what we know, and it's not just the fan base that's out on Chris Dunn, the Bulls are out on Chris Dunn. The Bulls and Chris Dunn, both sides want a fresh start, and his trade market value right now is precisely dick, and they're trying to do things about that, but there really isn't much to do about that other than keeping him on the roster and trying to showcase his talents leading up to the February 2020 trade deadline. That is a position that they're in, and by and large, it is a position that they have put themselves in, and John Paxson has put himself in because of the ways that he has commented about Chris Dunn.
He's also been commenting, saying that Chris Dunn is not done with the Bulls. He's been pretty clear on that they still believe in Chris Dunn. He's just bringing in competition to compete.
Lip service overcorrecting when literally 30 seconds before he said that, he left Chris Dunn's name off the list of players.
And he apologized.
Okay,
and he apologized.
Yeah.
He said he should have said
And he wasn't thinking about it because he's as good as gone.
So let's move on. Let's grade the period. Fred, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate Garpax's free agency signings throughout the period?
3.8.
Very consistent. Very consistent.
I loved this year. I thought it was A+. The thinking behind Parker was solid, so I was a fan. And that became Otto Porter Jr., so it's a big homer.
Matt, what about you?
1.
Oof. Matt the Russian Judge Peck.
Here you go. Here you go. Here you go. They get negative. They get negative 5 for Wade. They get negative 5 for Jabari. And then collectively between 2014 and 2019, the semi-logical signings that they've made add up from somewhere. You start at negative 10 and you find 11 points in there somewhere with all those names.
All
you
right.
Work your way back to positive 1.
If he's given negative 5 for Jabari, I'm giving Gasol a plus 17. Pick and 17.
The scale tops at 5, Fred. You can't go any higher
than
5.
You gave him a negative 5. You can't go below 0.
Of course you can. Of course you can.
What's going on here? Matt, be in control here, will you?
Yeah, well, I'm going to give it a 2.5 out of 5. I really like the signings as of late, but some of the earlier signings with Wade, Rondo, Jabari, I'm not a huge fan of, so I'm going to go 2.5 out of 5 for this period. So we'll be grading trades and coaching decisions in part 2.